We can all picture the story. Adam and Eve, naked as jaybirds, are wandering in the garden. That devious, cunning, and above all evil snake points out the fruit to Eve and whispers suggestively to her, "Take, eat, for then you will be wise." Eve plucks a luscious fruit and bites into it suggestively. Juice runs down her chin and between her naked breasts, and Adam swoons. Eve flutters her eyelashes at him. "Take, eat, for then you will be wise," she murmurs. And Adam reaches out his hand to the ripe and fragrant fruit, raises it to his lips, and eats. And in this way does sin enter the world. And it's all the fault of this woman, Eve. The Apostle Paul thinks so, the author of 1 Timothy thinks so, and the Church Fathers think so. Hundreds of medieval and Renaissance artists think so. Numerous paintings portray this woman as sensual, sexual, and seductive. Some even portray Adam gesturing towards Eve, his fingers held in a crude Italian symbol for vagina, a gesture which I saw used in Italy a few years ago. Across Europe and the United States, Eve was named as the ancestor of all witches, and her name has been invoked time and time again in the torture and slaughter of women during great witch hunts. Eve was the one who was willingly deceived by the snake. Eve was the one who knowingly lured Adam into sin. And so because of Eve, all humanity is cursed. And on the assumption that all women are made in her image and not in God's, women have been silenced in God's name for millennia. Despite the best historical evidence, which clearly shows that women were named as early church leaders and sponsors, women have been silenced in the churches. Women have been silenced as scolds, with their tongues locked down by branks and their bodies contorted into pillories. Women have been silenced for being witches. These days, women are silenced through lower pay and discrimination in the workplace. Women are still silenced through church-condoned domestic violence. Women are silenced by the humiliation and shame of sexual violence and a culture which continues to blame the victim. Women are silenced when they are prohibited from exercising the gifts in pastoral ministry. And women are silenced, particularly in Sydney, in our climate, when they're stripped of their ordination when the political winds change. And even in our own circles, in which women are usually recognised as equals and granted the right to speak, women are still being silenced. Let me tell you a story about the time Paul and I became partners many, many years ago. We decided for many very good reasons to leave the church where we had met. When this was made public, I was invited to meet with a pastoral team. I went there to be told that I was a seductress and a Jezebel who was dragging Paul away from the church to his destruction. Nobody met with Paul. Nobody asked him why he was leaving, and nobody accused him of anything. Apparently, like Eve, I had such power over him that he was no longer able to think with any part of his body above the waist. He couldn't be reasoned with, and our leaving the church was all my fault. Needless to say, the accusations left me gobsmacked and humiliated, and very effectively silenced. I was 23. Even our own congregation is not immune. In the last few months at this church which I love very much, I've watched good men silence women and good women accept this. I've heard husbands belittle and humiliate their wives in front of others. I've seen men interrupt other men and no one bat an eyelid. And women told off for interrupting the same conversation as if they were rude children rather than mature adults trying to get a word in edgewise. And this treatment of women all arises out of a theology based on a particular picture of Eve. A picture of Eve as a devious and conniving woman who seduced Adam into sin and who's been blamed for the presence of evil in the world ever since. The picture is insidious. It runs through our culture, and so does the silencing of women. The problem is the picture is wrong. And what is worse, there are two New Testament texts which were written later, and they refer back to it, and they are also wrong. We need to remember that the Bible isn't consistent. It didn't drop down out of the sky one day, fully formed. It was written over many centuries and subjected to many influences. And when we go back to tonight's story and look at the influences on it, and when we read this story carefully, we might find a few surprises. First, we should look at what's not in the story. If you read it closely, there is no mention of sin. There's no mention of the fall. There's no hint that Eve is seductive. The word evil is never used. Neither Adam nor Eve are tricked into eating the fruit. The snake is not evil, merely crafty or devious. And in fact, the snake told the truth. So instead of the temptress, we have a story in which Eve makes a choice based on what the snake tells her. She considers and eats and offers the fruit to Adam. And despite being told by God not to eat the fruit, Adam too eats it. No deceit and no sex are implied. So where does this powerful idea of a seductive and deceitful Eve come from? It's not part of the Hebrew Bible. It actually comes from other writings, the pseudepigrapha. And these were early Jewish writings which were later rejected when the canon, which is what we call the Bible, was formed. They were rejected because the councils which decided on the canon believed that they did not faithfully describe humanity's relationship with God. In the Apocalypse of Moses, written in the 1st century AD, we first find a story in which Eve is described as having an affair with the devil. At her lover's command, she deliberately entices Adam to eat the fruit. Although the devil is not mentioned in the Hebrew Bible, in this apocryphal story, the devil is a driving force, and the power of the image is so great that you see it again and again in artworks all the way through the centuries. In a later book, The Life of Adam and Eve, which is a Latin text, all responsibility for sin is clearly allotted to Eve. And on Adam's deathbed, Eve begs God to absolve Adam from sin, since absolutely everything is her fault. Other apocryphal texts blame women for sexual depravity and for triggering desire in men, and describe men as completely innocent of sexual wrongdoing, even in stories of incest, rape, and gang rape. Unlike the stories which did make it into the Hebrew Bible, these stories maintain the status quo. They describe exactly how life is in the patriarchy. Men are in charge and have absolute power over women and women's bodies. Women are subservient and responsible for men's sin. And worse, these stories claim that this is ordained by God. This is exactly why the apocryphal stories were rejected from the canon. They were false descriptions of God's relationship with humanity. But they'd already done their destructive work. They'd already informed how people read the creation stories. They informed New Testament writers and early church fathers, leading them to read the stories of creation through patriarchal cultural blinkers and to use these stories to uphold the status quo. And so, for example, even although women were already accepted leaders and sponsors of the earliest Christian churches, the writer of 1 Timothy explicitly prohibited women from taking leadership roles and speaking in church because of what he perceived as Eve's absolute responsibility for the fall. And this false reading of Eve is why even now women continue to be silenced and oppressed and men continue to dominate. I think it's easy to settle for this picture of Eve. This story's been around for a long, long time. The problem is if we want to hold on to this image of Eve, Eve the temptress, and if we want to use this to justify male domination, then we have a rarely admitted philosophical problem. For a seductive Eve implies a spineless Adam who only thinks below the waist. A seductive Eve implies Adam the victim, powerless, gullible, and not capable of being in charge of anything. A seductive Eve suggests that Adam can't say no to anything or anyone, particularly if they're pretty. And Adam is shown to be a weakling. Adam didn't even participate in the conversation with the serpent. He just took the fruit and ate it. And this is not the image of God that we might hope for in a man. If we go back to the Hebrew Bible and look at the stories which actually did make it into the canon, instead of Eve the seductress and Adam the chinless wonder, we find a different picture of humanity. In the first story of creation, God created humanity in God's image. In the image of God, God created them. Male and female, God created them. There was no differentiation between male and female. They were both made in the image of God. They were both blessed. They were both told to be fruitful and multiply. They were both instructed to tend the earth. They were both granted everything. And God saw that this was good. Even more, in the commandment to be fruitful and multiply, God blessed man and woman with sex. Desire wasn't something to be ashamed of. Desire wasn't something that was anybody's fault, particularly not Eve's. Instead, desire was a blessing from God. In the second story of creation, of which we heard a little bit tonight, in this story we're hearing answers to the big questions. Where do we come from? Why are we here? Why do we work so hard for so little? Why is childbirth painful? Why do men dominate women? Why do people do the wrong things? And so on. And the story is told to provide answers. For example, we're told that Eve is formed from Adam's rib. To our modern ears, this can sound very condescending. But what it's telling us is that Adam and Eve are made of the same stuff. Unlike other ancient writings which were floating around at the time, and these other ancient writings speculated that since women were so inferior and so disgusting, they must be made of different or flawed materials, some writers even speculating they were made of fecal matter. Here we have a different story, a radical story, which says that Eve is made of the same stuff as Adam. And so, therefore, we are told that women are made of the same stuff as men. Even more, this story too goes on to tell us that this is why we have sex. And so we learn again that sex is not a problem, not Eve's fault, but a part of the divine order. What else can we learn from this story? If we can shelve the baggage which tells us that Eve is a conniving woman, we might notice she has some other qualities. For it's Eve who makes the first choice. She shows us that humans are free to choose to do what God instructs. We're also completely free to do otherwise. Our choices have consequences, and these consequences can be serious. But what is amazing and what is instructive is the idea that we've been given the freedom to choose in the first place. So Eve shows us that we have free will. Eve shows us how hungry we are for wisdom and life. She took the fruit in order to experience fullness of life. It wasn't the right path to wisdom. There are other ways that aren't so quick and easy. But she shows us a curiosity and a thirst for life, a part of human nature. She also shows us that from the beginning, we're rarely willing to take the hard road on our journey into wisdom and maturity. Like her, we want the quick fix. Eve shows us how to live with hope. After leaving the garden, she gets on with life, desiring her husband, tending the earth, enduring childbirth, bearing sons, grieving the death and violence in her family. Even outside the garden, she engages in the creation. Her story shows us what happens when we make bad choices. Life doesn't end. Instead, we experience the consequences, and then from the new place in which we find ourselves, we start again. This fuller picture of Eve, made in the image of God, thirsty for knowledge and life, resilient in the face of difficult change, enriches all of us. And it challenges us, because it challenges us to look for the image of God in every woman and girl we see. It challenges us to think about why we find it so easy to ignore, ridicule, or silence women, even when we think of them as equals. It challenges us to reflect on how our churches are formed and run, and how our governments operate, how conversations are conducted and decisions are made. It challenges us to see how women, whether in our kitchens, our churches, our workplaces, or on the other side of the world, are oppressed through violence, humiliation, or merely silencing, all because we still struggle to acknowledge that she too is made in God's image. But until women are equally part of the formation and running of our institutions and systems of power, until women and men can work side by side together and respect each other as equal participants and contributors, until all women are safe from violence and humiliation by partners, husbands and fathers, until female Baptist ordination candidates don't have to be told again and again that there are far fewer opportunities and many closed doors for them, until women in other denominations are eligible for ordination in the first place, until the very idea of the female is perceived as normal, just as male is normal. Until this, our families, our churches, and our society will reflect far less than half the image of God. For God is not found in the male alone, but in male and female working together. We're well on the way. I'm standing here speaking to you tonight, and no one's stoned me yet. But we do have more work to do in our church systems and in our relationships with one another. We're called to be witnesses to a way of love, healing, reconciliation and justice. And we will be when we let God's vision of male and female working together in harmony be our model and our guide. For us, it probably means small, important things. Thinking before we speak, wondering whether we're allowing each other equal airtime, noticing our deep-seated prejudices and assumptions about women, paying attention to the ways we talk and the ways we make decisions, and gradually learning to find ways to make room for all voices and all styles of expression, argument, decision-making. On a wider stage, just think how this vision of equality might play out. Once we recognise that all women, like all men, are made in the image of God, the ramifications are enormous. For women in the sweatshops, women in the sex trade, women in violent relationships, public women who are ripped to shreds by the media, women who are blamed for their own rape, and so many others. To these women, what could it mean for us to stand up and say, you too are equal, equally formed, equally capable, equally responsible, and equally precious to God? On the sixth day, women and men were made in the image of God, called to be partners in God's ongoing creative work. We'll never get back to the garden. Our way is barred. And yet we yearn for God's original vision for us. And so for the day when all people experience God's radical and abundant love and the pouring out of justice which is demanded by that love, we are called to work and hope and pray.